Hello, I'm Eric Corman, Communications Director at the League of Education Voters. State Senator Christine Rolfes represents the 23rd Legislative District, including the Kitsap County communities of Hansville, Kingston, Paulsboro, Bainbridge Island, Keyport, Silverdale, and East Bremerton. Since her election to the State House of Representatives in 2007, Christine has been a leading voice on education funding and reform, small businesses, ferries, military families and veterans, and the environment. Her efforts have yielded tangible results for the 23rd District and Washington State as a whole. Christine sits on the Early Learning and K-12 Education, Rules, and Ways and Means Committees. She also serves on several task forces and select committees, including the Joint Select Task Force on Nuclear Energy, the Education Funding Task Force, and the Joint Committee on Veterans and Military Affairs. After earning a Bachelor's of Arts degree in Economics from the University of Virginia and a Master's in Public Administration from the University of Washington, Christine worked for the Kitsap County Department of Community Development as an Open Space Program Coordinator and Watershed Planner. She later moved to the United States Agency for International Development, USAID, where she counseled Northwest businesses and organizations on humanitarian assistance and commercial opportunities overseas. Also for USAID, Christine spent time working out of the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, Russia, managing environmental and economic development projects. Christine, your work is amazing. What do you see as the biggest challenge in the upcoming legislative session, and what gives you most hope for a good outcome for kids?
Thank you for having me here. Thanks for asking me that question. I have a lot of hope for kids. First of all, I truly believe that whatever comes out of the legislative session is going to result in better outcomes in our schools and better funding for our schools. So if we can get the four sides together, the House and Senate Democrats and the House and Senate Republicans, and continue to make progress, we will be doing a good thing. I'm hopeful that we'll be able to solve the complicated puzzle for school funding that we have before us. The worst case scenario, I've been telling parents in my district, it will be better than last year. Whatever we do should be better. So the biggest challenge before the legislature right now is not just about meeting the Supreme Court's requirement that we step up to our constitutional duty and fund the schools. The challenge is actually the financial challenge of how do we pay for it. And on top of the school funding issue, we also have really significant needs in things like mental health, wildfire suppression. State employees probably deserve small raises after their salaries have been decreased by the recession and health insurance. So we have this huge menu of needs and an economy that's growing, but that still forces us to make really difficult choices.
How do you think we could make those choices? Are there clear ways that we can solve this puzzle?
You know, we always solve it. The legislature always solves it. We might not all love the solution that we come up with, but we always solve it. I personally don't believe we can do it without new revenue. How we decide to get that revenue, that's the big question, and how much new revenue will we need? You know, my position, and I think a position of Senate Democrats, has been everything's on the table. Let's see what works. Let's see what doesn't hurt the economy. What is useful and stable and sustainable for our schools, and start from there, knowing that nobody likes to pay taxes and no politicians like to vote for taxes. The suggestions before us range from income tax. There's a pretty strong contingent that wants to see tax reform come out of this, but there's also a pretty strong contingent in the legislature that feels confident that the voters would not support that. But that's one end of the spectrum. And then the other end of the spectrum is no new revenue, do it all within the existing budget. And so we got to reconcile those two extremes.
Yeah, I don't envy your job in times like that. You did mention needs, and some of the needs are pretty great, especially in the education system. How do you think the talk about education funding can address gaps, both the achievement gap and the opportunity gap? I mean, what can we do about those?
Well, there are a lot of things, and how we do that is not as partisan as how are we going to fund it. I think there's a lot of room for sharing interests, and one shared interest is increasing and improving outcomes for all kids, whether they're urban or rural, wealthy or poor. There's genuine support in the legislature for that. We know that kids who enter kindergarten prepared do better throughout their career. So there's pretty strong support for early childhood learning, especially for kids that aren't getting that at home. Mm. There's really strong support for We call it Learning Assistance Programs, LAP is the lingo, but for additional funding for the kids that need it the most. So kids that might need before school tutoring, after school classes, or a zero period added on in the high school to make sure they get the credits that they need. That kind of funding, things that are helping kids learn English, if English is their second language, or help them with reading and math, particularly if they have learning disabilities. So that pot of money that we call LAP, there seems to be support for increasing that so that the kids who need it the most will get the support they need, regardless of where they live.
Is there a way to make sure that the money actually gets to the LAP program? Because I know that what happens sometimes is the money will go to a district, and then the district finds themselves in the middle of a salary negotiation. They're like, oh my God, what are we going to do? And so they'll pull money from buckets that it's not really supposed to come from and put it into teacher salaries.
You know, teacher salary is a whole related but different conversation. But the LAP program has generally been popular in the legislature and well-received in the districts because it can't be bargained. We call it programmatic. So it needs to be spent on what the legislature sent it to be spent on. One weakness right now is that the legislature several years ago said the first priority for LAP is teaching kids how to read. We gave the districts a little bit more money, but in a lot of districts that caused the LAP money to be moved out of, say, math or out of the middle schools. And so there's a general recognition right now that the districts could use more LAP funds to help more kids.
Yeah, I heard that some of the districts misinterpreted what the new guidelines were and that the money could only go toward reading programs. And so, yeah, it seemed like that added to the confusion. Like, oh, yeah, we got all these other kids here, but wait, we have to look at reading first.
Well, we also said reading's a priority for it. And so if you have elementary schools where the kids are really struggling, where the gap is really big, it is true that if you have to get all those third graders reading, which they didn't have to do before, that's where your money's going to have to go.
Yeah, and that makes sense. If you can't read by the time you're in third grade, then it's going to be really hard to do anything else.
Yeah, and that's what they say. Like up to age 10, you're learning to read. After age 10, you're reading to learn. And so everybody's got to know how to read by then.
Absolutely.
So actually, one of the things that I think was cool about really forcing the districts to make sure every kid can read is that I'm hopeful that that means that learning disabilities and vision problems are being identified early. I'm not sure we have the funding in LAP to actually help with vision testing, but that's clearly a place where there's a lot of room for improvement, and that's a really easy way to help a kid learn.
You talked earlier about teacher salaries and how that is a whole can of worms. And one of the task forces that you sit on is the Education Funding Task Force. At the most recent meeting of the task force, you were presented with a study on the cost of K-12 staff salaries across Washington school districts. What do you think were the big takeaways from that?
We just got this huge report, really detailed information. It was stuff that probably everybody in the legislature who's going to work on this needs as a starting place. The takeaway from the report, though, was more about thank you for this detail. Now we can do our work. The outcome, if you're going to look at the executive summary, we all kind of knew that information. We just needed the data to be able to make meaningful decisions about it. What that report showed us was that levies are paying a very large percent, maybe a quarter, 25% on the average salaries across the state. That is not going to be equitable based on where levies are passed and where they're not and how much the levies are, et cetera. So we got the numbers that we need to be able to see where is the salary issue, where's the unfairness coming from, and how do we start to fix that?
What do you think at this point would be the best fix for that?
Well, there are a couple of different ways you could look at it. The basic premise is that it's the state's responsibility to pay the salary of the teachers. So a teacher that's teaching fourth grade math, their salary, if they're not coaching football or doing anything extra, their salary should be wholly paid by the state. It's a constitutional mandate. Mm-hmm. Right now, that's mostly not happening. Right now, the levies are paying for part of that. So what we need to look at is what should a fair salary be across the state for every fourth grade teacher, and how much of that can the state pay? So do we want the state to be paying that entire salary, or do we want to leave some flexibility for the levies to pay for that? But the starting point is, what would it cost the state if we were really going to pay the base salary of every teacher? What's the average fourth grade teacher being paid across the state? There are teachers being paid less, and there are teachers being paid significantly more. and where they're being paid significantly more and it's coming out of levies, the state legislature may not want to raise every fourth grade teacher to that highest rate.
Everett.
In terms of salary, right? Yeah, and I mean, Everett is the poster child for very high salaries.
Mm-hmm.
You can argue that those salaries are fair, and that's what a teacher should be being paid. So the discussion needs to be, is Everett our goal, or is an average market rate salary across the state the goal? And then there's another conversation to be had regarding, do teachers in Seattle, should they be paid more than teachers in rural Washington where the average salary is lower?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of complicating factors there. But the basic question is, what should the state be paying for?
Yeah, and that is a big question.
Yeah. Although I have to say, there has been bipartisan agreement in the past that no teachers are going to have salary cuts as a result of whatever we do. So that's actually a big starting point.
That's encouraging. Outside of funding, though, what would you say is the biggest challenge facing public education in the state?
And, you know, if you're going to look at, like, one statistic, I would say graduation rates.
Mm.
We have, as a state, have very competitive and really good graduation requirements put in place. This year's freshmen, that's the first class that's going to have to comply with new guidelines. 24 credits to graduate, which means you can't fail anything.
Mm.
And high standards for a lot of the basic coursework. So the challenge, I think, facing the state is, how do we get our graduation rate up from, which I'm going to say is high 70s, but you may have a different number, but somewhere in the 70s.
Yes.
How do we get that up to maybe 95?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right? 78, I think is what I had.
Yeah, how do we get that so that all kids are able to graduate? Then if that's your goal, it takes you all the way back to kindergarten, because you got to make sure everybody can read and do basic math by third grade in order for them to stay on track.
Do you see a system where basic education could include early learning and pre-K?
I don't see a system that's constitutionally mandated that requires early learning and pre-K. But I do see a system where the legislature is committed to making sure kids enter kindergarten on an equal footing.
That would be great.
The other challenge, but it's actually, it's an opportunity, right, is to fully fund and really accelerate the career and technical education programs throughout the state. So what we old-timers, what we middle-aged people used to consider, we used to call it vocational education, right?
Mm-hmm.
So not just back in the day, you know, wood shop and home ec, right? But now it's nutrition sciences, and it can teach you science as well as lead you on a career pathway. Or it's composites engineering and architecture and learning how to, you know, use computers to scale things up. But that whole realm of career and technical education and making sure that every school district can afford to provide kids with those career opportunities, whether kids are going to go to a four-year school or they're going to go right into a career. I personally think even the kids heading for a four-year degree need to have some useful skills. I mean, how many of us would have really benefited from automotive technical training in high school, right? All of us would have. Or basic engineering, basic electrical science. You know, a lot of stuff that I'd like to see today's students exposed to that in middle school and then armed with some really good choices throughout their high school career to delve into things in more detail.
Well, it seems like there's two reasons to do it. I mean, can't you get math credits for some of the career technical stuff so that you can see how you apply the actual numbers to doing something in the real world?
Yeah, absolutely. And some kids learn a lot better doing hands-on. So you can get science credits. I think a lot of the schools in Eastern Washington may be offering kind of agricultural sciences or horticulture. That counts, and it's a career science. You don't just have to take chemistry and physics to be successful in college or your career. So I think there are a lot of great opportunities. The other part of that is computers and software, software engineering, software design. I feel really strongly that that should be mandated in our schools, but I'm not going to mandate anything without funding it. And I don't think we're there. I would like to see more of that in the middle school so that girls find out early on whether that's for them. There's a lot of self-selection by the time you get to AP computer science, which students are choosing that. I think software design and engineering is something that most of this younger generation is going to need to have a good handle on for their careers.
Oh, absolutely. It'll be needed in whatever field they're in. And it seems like having that career exposure in middle school really can get their wheels turning about, okay, what do I really want to do? Because I thought I wanted to be a doctor when I was in high school. boy, was I wrong.
So I did too, but that's probably because we didn't have a lot of like choices, right? There's a doctor, there's a nurse, there's a teacher. You had your standard choices of careers. We didn't have exposure to the detailed careers.
Right, and we didn't even have a lot of exposure to the narrow band of careers that we thought was available. If I'd seen what it meant to be a doctor back when I was in middle school, I would have gotten a jump start on doing what I really wanted to do.
Yeah, I think my middle school had where you took a personality test and it showed you what your careers might be, and mine was forest ranger and flight attendant.
That's awesome.
The two self-identified.
How can people listening to this podcast help you in Olympia do what you need to do to fully fund education and improve outcomes for students?
I've been saying the legislature has been deadlocked on this for a while. We have had bipartisan agreement to move forward on specific items like all-day kindergarten, smaller class sizes in the elementary school, and we've funded what we've been able to get bipartisan agreement on. The recent elections basically returned everybody back to the legislature. There was not a big mandate one way or the other, mm-hmm. right? And there were Supreme Court races where the judges were returned who made the difficult McCleary decision. So there was no mandate that the voters didn't like that either. So we basically have the voters sending back the status quo. And what we really need from voters is a sense that this is important and that their legislators should be tackling this as problem number one, whether they're from rural Eastern Washington or urban Seattle, that solving this education funding challenge should be the key priority.
Right, and maybe making sure that the outcomes for kids are improved, because sometimes just putting more money into a system won't necessarily change anything.
That is true, but I'm pretty confident that if we put more money in a smart way, it will. I don't think we're going to get better outcomes without investing more.
That makes sense.
You know, it's chicken or the egg, but we need them. We kind of need them both.
How did you decide to run for office in the first place?
You know, I ran for office. One of my core values is environmental and really being concerned about the planet and the health of the environment, clean air, clean water, wildlife. So I actually ran originally for local government on a more of a land use platform. With my experience on a city council, I got exposed to a lot more public safety, transportation, et cetera, and that just led to a more general interest in all governmental issues and politics.
And then making the leap from city council to the House of Representatives for you was a pretty easy step?
It wasn't easy.
How was it?
Nothing
hard?
Easy about running for higher office, but it was a natural choice to make.
Did you have a lot of support from other legislators to make that jump?
Yeah, and I actually had a lot of support from the people that I was representing. You can't do it without a base, right?
That's for sure.
Yeah.
Now that you're in the Senate, what do you see as the next step? The education funding issue is huge. But what would you like to do after that?
It's funny you ask that. I first ran in 2006 and won, and the local newspaper, the Kitsap Sun on the peninsula, asked me and my opponent both, you know, in 5 years, what do you want to see accomplished? And literally in 2006, I said, I would like to know that we're fully funding our public schools.
Wow.
I ran again this year and, you know, I got reelected. And so I have another 4 years. And so my primary goal is let's get this job done.
So, yeah, this is clearly job one.
Job one, yeah. And I want to leave office knowing that the ferry system is sustainable and that we're on the path to addressing climate change and that we have Puget Sound on the road to recovery. And, you know, I have lots of little goals there.
Would you ever want to run for a statewide office?
The answer is I wouldn't rule that out. but it's not an ambition that I have today.
State Senator Christine Rolfes represents the 23rd District. Christine, thank you so much for coming in.
All right. Thank you.